Nutrition's Cafe programs are now available worldwide as podcasts. You can find them at the iTunes Store and on many podcast sites and mobile apps. You can also find our podcasts and much more on our website, newdimensions.org.
I'm here with Dr. Dean Radin. He's the chief scientist at the Institute of Noetic Sciences and the author of Real Magic, Ancient Wisdom, Modern Science, and A Guide to the Secret Power of the Universe. And if you want to know more about his work, you can go to his website, Dean Radin, radin.org, or you can get there through the New Dimensions website, newdimensions.org. Dean, we started off our conversation, you talked about the three types of real magic, and one, you said force of will, another was divination. So I'd love for you to say something about divination, and I want to say, first, I'm going to say something about divination, because I just had an experience of it just recently. One of the things that I use for divination in my life, I don't use it very often, and that's the I Ching, which is an ancient tradition of hexagrams, of throwing coins or yarrow sticks and getting a hexagram in answer to some question. And in this kind of divination, it's really important the question you ask. You don't ask a yes or no question. You ask for advice or to ask what is the culture around which this, whatever it is happening, something like that. And I noticed for myself, as I say, I only do this maybe three or four times a year. So when I do it, I know that I'm going to go to it, and I'm whatever it is that it's going to tell me, I'm going to take the advice, that I go with that kind of intention. And I learned that from years ago with my husband, because this was back in, I mean, like 1972, that he had this question of the I Ching, and he asked, and he got the answer, and he didn't really like the answer. So he kind of redid the question. It was really the same question, but he asked it again, and he didn't like the second answer he got. So he went to it the third time. And when he went to it the third time, he got the hexagram. It's called Youthful Folly. It said, if you're not going to believe me, then just don't come to me anymore, is what it really amounted to say. Well, of course, he never did that again. And so that's why I also use that very, very seriously. And always the advice that it gives me just seems tailor-made to the question I'm asking. So with that little long preamble, I'd love for you to say something about divination and your experience of it.
So divination can be perception through space or time. Through space, we have the words like clairvoyance and remote viewing, and through time, precognition. So interestingly, of the range of scientific evidence for psychic phenomena, the evidence for precognition is the best. So when you think about how confident are you that these various forms of magic exist, divination, I think, is by far the strongest. Possibly because it is simply more difficult to manifest things in the physical world than it is to passively perceive them. In terms of precognition, all of the evidence suggests that we perceive probable futures. We don't see the future that will actually occur, which I think is nice because it suggests that maybe free will is a real thing, that we have a sense that we can choose what unfolds and we don't have to do something because it happens to be fated. So I could describe one type. There's several different classes of ways that we know about precognition, but if you like, I can talk about one.
Please.
So this is a method that I call presentiment, because precognition suggests that you pre-know something, cognize, whereas presentiment is pre-feel. So the pre-feeling experience is actually the most common that people have in terms of psychic effects, and they might not even think of it as psychic. They may think of it as an intuitive hunch or a gut feeling or something like that. The way it's expressed in my own experience, and I know in others as well, is that you're driving towards a green light This actually happened to me about 6 months ago. You see a green light, you're driving towards it. You can't, because a building is blocking it or something, you can't see who's on the other road, the crossroad, but you have a green light. So typically what people do is speed up a little bit because you want to make the light. And for some reason, I'm approaching the light and I'm slowing down. And I'm thinking, well, there's something wrong about this. I don't like it. There are no other cars around. There's a car behind me who's wondering why I'm slowing down. But there are no other cars around. So I'm slowing down. It gets slower and slower as the light remains green. Now the person behind me is getting angry. And as I approach the road where I can now turn into the road, I come to almost a complete stop. And just then, somebody blasts through the red light crossways at about 50 miles an hour. Didn't even slow down for the light. So they clearly didn't see it or something. And I realized at that point that if I kept going at the same speed, I would have been hit broadside, maybe killed. So this was a pre-feeling, except I didn't feel good about this. I had no knowledge of it. So in the laboratory, the challenge is how do we simulate that so we can study that kind of phenomena without putting somebody at risk? So we have a method that works, and it works really well. First of all, we're looking at your unconscious response. So we wire you up to look at usually the autonomic nervous system. And you can measure that through things like pupil dilation and skin conductance and heart rate and so on, those kinds of physiological effects, which are very sensitive ways of figuring out what's happening below your level of awareness. So we're looking at your unconscious. And then you wire somebody up, you have them sit down in front of a computer. They're told they press a button, and then the screen remains blank for 5 seconds, and then a picture comes up. The picture is chosen at random from a large pool of pictures, some of which are very emotional and some are very calm. And then they see that picture for 3 seconds. The picture goes away for about 10 seconds, and then when they're ready, they press the button and they do the same kind of experiment. So the picture is selected truly at random. Nobody knows in advance what's about to occur, and it's not selected until just the instant before it's shown. So it's not a clairvoyance experiment because it doesn't exist while we're recording your physiology beforehand. It only exists the instant before it shows up. So it's a true precognition experiment. The prediction is that if you're in fact responding to a future fright or emotional condition, that your body will behave differently, become more aroused than if you're about to see something calm. So we've done this experiment with hundreds of people now and has been repeated in labs around the world. And what you see again and again with virtually every physiological measure that we've looked at, including not only autonomic nervous system, but also the central nervous system, that the body begins to gear up in advance of seeing or experiencing something emotional as compared to something calm. So this is a way of taking a real life event that many people talk about in one way or the other, put it into a lab context where we understand what's happening, and we see that there's a statistically significant difference. What's even more exciting, though, is the experiment that I just described, where you're looking at series of pictures, some of which are emotional and some are calm. This is done like every day in Psychophysiology 101. It's a way of studying how does the body respond to emotion. So there are thousands of such studies that have been done. So my colleagues asked, they first of all looked through the literature to find people who had done similar experiments, the same design, asked for the raw data, because what they could do is take that same experiment and do the analysis that we did, which was look what happened before the picture showed up. And in the databases they were able to get, they found this same effect. This is important because it means that we're talking about something which exists probably in everyone. And it exists in existing experiments which are conducted for other reasons. So it's not only that the experimenters might have been skeptical, they were completely unaware that they were doing a presentiment experiment, which we then found in the data only afterwards.
This is very exciting, these experiments that you're talking about and this information that you're gathering. So are you finding there's a receptivity in scientific journals and magazines that are just going crazy over this and saying, wow, this is a new science and we need to really follow up on this? What's the verdict?
Well, for the scientific papers that are published, we find that a meta-analysis was done by a colleague looking at experiments like this presentiment experiment. It was published in a well-regarded journal. We know because of the statistics on it that it's been viewed over 90,000 times. So you compare that with a typical journal article, which if you're doing really well, might be looked at 100 times, 200 times. This is 90,000 times, which means it's getting a huge amount of play. It's the equivalent of a viral paper, only in, mm-hmm. not in the YouTube sense, but as an article that people are paying attention to, yes, it attracts a lot of attention. But that's about it. And the reason why it doesn't go much further than that, why we don't see everybody jumping on board and just trying to do this, is first of all, that particular experiment does require some expertise in psychophysiology. So that cuts down who can do it. But more importantly, people will then say, well, how do you explain that this works? Because it seems to violate the laws of physics, right? We expect cause and effect to only go in one direction. There's a second law of thermodynamics, blah, blah, blah. To which I would say, yeah, I understand all that. It does seem to be a challenge to our understanding of causality. And yet we're talking about facts. This is experimental, empirical research which shows that this happens even though we don't know how it happens. So up until very recently, it was difficult to say, first of all, purely from a theoretical perspective, you can say that all of the equations of classical and quantum mechanics are time symmetric. They don't say in the equations which way things go. Our experience says it usually goes in just one direction. That's certainly what my clock says. But at least from a mathematical perspective, that's not necessary. It's like empirically we see that in our everyday lives, but it's not necessary from the mathematics. More importantly, just recently, within a couple of weeks before this interview, a study was published showing that at a quantum scale, you can reverse the second law of thermodynamics.
Oh, now wait, that's huge. Now say what the law of thermodynamics is.
Well, the second law of thermodynamics is what we usually think of as the flow of time. It's in one direction. It's in a preferred direction from order to less order. That's the direction of entropy. It's like the eventual heat death of the universe. That's the thing that's pulling us in that direction. And at the macroscopic scale, the scale of everyday life, that's what our clocks tell us too, except occasionally when we have a precognitive experience which suggests that some information somehow came back to us. But an experiment that was a predicted effect, but now experimentally verified, that at least at the low scale, at the bottom scale of physics, quantum mechanics currently, that the second order of thermodynamics can be reversed experimentally. That means that since quantum mechanics is a better description of the physical world than the classical one, that what we're seeing in these experiments is not violating what we know about what is possible in the physical world. And this will still persist because people don't pay attention to every possible thing out there. Mm-hmm. No one can. But the old complaint that these kinds of effects, not only precognition, but force of will and these other effects, that they violate physics, none of that is actually true.
All right. Okay. All right. Well, now we're getting down to it. I want to remind our listeners that I'm here with Dr. Dean Radin, and he's the chief scientist at the Institute of Noetic Sciences, and he is the author of Real Magic, Ancient Wisdom, Modern Science, and a Guide to the Secret Power of the Universe. If you'd like to know more about his work, you can go to his website, deanradin.org, or get there through the New Dimensions website, newdimensions.org. I'm Justine Willis-Toms. You're listening to New Dimensions.
Thank you.
I'm here with Dr. Dean Radin, and he is the chief scientist at the Institute of Noetic Sciences and the author of Real Magic, Ancient Wisdom, Modern Science, and a Guide to the Secret Power of the Universe. Dean, I need to ask you, why did you write this book?
Why would a scientist write a book on magic?
Exactly.
Yeah. Well, if you had asked me this question 2 years ago and said, are you going to write a book on magic? Are you doing magic? I would have said, that's ridiculous. Why would I ever want to write a book on magic? And now I've written that book. So what happened in the interim? What happened is that when you take a scientific worldview, it's understood in terms of reductive materialism. That's like the worldview, the way, the lens through which we view things. The reductive part says that in order to understand something, you take it apart. If you want to know how a watch works, you break it up and you look at the gears and you can figure out how it works. The material part is that you assume that everything starts at its fundamental level with matter and energy. And so far, that idea of reductive materialism has been extremely successful. It allows us to do all of the fancy technologies that we know today and much of the rest of the world. So I, like many scientists, have been thinking of psychic phenomena in terms of how do we explain it within this lens? I mean, after all, science has been really successful. Why do you want to change any of it? In addition, I notice that when I tell my more conservative colleagues that I've been spending my professional career studying psychic phenomena, they immediately say, well, what you're doing can't possibly be real because it would require us to throw away all our textbooks and start over again. And to which I agree. So I said, I don't know how it can be real, but I agree that the textbooks are too good. We have hundreds of years of knowledge that says that certain things work certain ways. So my challenge to myself was, what do we do with the scientific worldview if we want to understand the very phenomena that I've been studying, which I know are real because we see it in the laboratory? And so the answer was, we need a slightly expanded version of the scientific worldview, maybe more than slightly, but we need a version of it that stays the same. All right, when science advances, the old theories are not thrown away, typically. They become more comprehensive. Quantum mechanics is a more comprehensive way of describing the world than classical.
So you're talking about like rings of a tree.
Yes. You don't throw away what works. You expand it and make it more comprehensive. So I said, okay, how can I expand the current scientific worldview to accommodate psychic phenomena? And I figured out a way of doing that, which I write about in the book. And the moment I did that, I realized, holy smoke, that means that what these anthropologists have been studying, primarily anthropologists, about the so-called beliefs of primitive societies, magic, those are probably real. This is real stuff we're talking about. And it took this expanded worldview idea to be able to see it in those terms. And now, after about 2 years of study on this, I've pretty much flipped from the standard materialistic viewpoint to one that a philosopher would call idealism. And of course, this is completely about what you think consciousness is. That's where the crux is. So that's why the subtitle of the book is The Secret Power of the Universe. The secret power of the universe is that it's not made out of matter and energy and physical stuff. It's probably made out of consciousness, which is not physical.
It's so fascinating, too. And I just want to tell our listeners that there is a portion of the book that's dedicated to that. You take us through the ages. You really do the whole beautifully done history of all of the esoteric literature and traditions, and that was just fascinating. So that's a whole part of the book, and so it's all there in there. But I'm so glad that you're starting to touch on consciousness, and that you're saying so there's something beyond energy and matter. I mean, that's the materialistic viewpoint of the universe, that it all is quantifiable as energy and matter, and that's it. That's where we are. And you're adding in and also consciousness, which is this other realm that is not so measurable. I know that scientists feel that there are many neuroscientists that feel like that mind and brain are the same thing, but you're saying that the brain is not maybe the seat of consciousness. And what would you say about that?
Well, you know, it's true that the neurosciences assume that consciousness emerges out of brain function. And I would say, well, maybe not consciousness, if we define consciousness as awareness, subjectivity. That, I think, probably is not generated by the brain. However, if we think of mind and think of mind in terms of cognition and information processing, perception and all that stuff, that may well be actually produced in the brain. The brain as an object has evolved over millions of years to allow this organism, the human body, to participate in the world in a certain way, in a refined way. So I think to some extent our memories and to a large extent our perceptions, our thinking, our mental apparatus, these may well be correlated with the brain. Not only correlated, but maybe even caused. However, the puzzle is not so much about the information processing, it's about the awareness of it, the internal awareness that this is happening, or said another way, the mystery is that you have any experience at all. We can make a robot that simulates what humans do, as we're beginning to do now. We don't have any sense that the robot is aware of what they're doing. So what is it then? Where does that awareness come from? Sometimes people will say, I don't believe that. I think the consciousness emerges out of the brain, to which I respond, who's asking that question? Who's the I? What's the I that is asking right. that question? What's even funnier, people say, I don't believe in consciousness. I don't even exist because it's all brain stuff. Again, well, who's having the illusion that you don't believe this? So this, of course, you can go all the way back to people like Ramana Maharshi and others who use that as a meditation to begin to ask in greater and greater detail from an introspection perspective, what do you think you are? But this will deflect us into an entirely different conversation.
Right.
So the point then is that if it is true that the brain gives rise to every aspect of consciousness that we know, then it becomes very difficult to understand any kind of psychic experience or mystical experience as anything other than a delusion. Except we know from the laboratory that it's not a delusion. So we need to accommodate the fact that maybe a lot of ourselves are localized roughly around the body and brain, but not all. Because if you get somebody who's really good at remote viewing, they could see what's happening on Pluto. They could see what's happening 2 days from next Tuesday on Pluto. Well, how can they do that? You can't do that if all of your consciousness is generated in the brain, because Pluto's too far away and tomorrow's too far away. So we need a more expansive view of what we think is going on. And interestingly, when you begin to look at both philosophers and scientists, more and more beginning to like ideas like panpsychism and neutral monism and other words like that, all of which are saying that there is some element of the fabric of reality which is sentient, all the way down to electrons or even below that perhaps, that there is awareness at every scale of existence. So we are a certain scale. We have a certain kind of object in our head that allows us to process the world and be aware of it in a certain way, a human way. That suggests, though, that consciousness is simply a more comprehensive way of thinking about physical reality itself. And that is, in fact, when you go through all of the esoteric traditions, that's what those esoteric traditions are saying. Consciousness is more fundamental. First of all, consciousness is fundamental, but it's more fundamental than the constructs we have of space and time and matter and energy.
And this goes back to Max Planck, who's the father of quantum theory, who says, I regard consciousness is fundamental. Right. So, I mean, going back to this father of all of this is saying that. And I also love the analogy where you talk about how we affect change, and you talk about the elephant shaking, that we affect change and we think, well, why can't I just make this work all the time? And sometimes we're just the tail wagging and it's not going to wag the whole elephant. And sometimes it's a whole elephant shaking, and that's that collective consciousness. So we have less than 30 seconds. Is there anything that you want to say about that analogy or anything else that you'd like to leave us with today, Dean?
Well, that analogy was talking about the when people hear about magic and magic spells and all of that, say, well, why can't I wish for a gold Mercedes to just show up tomorrow? Well, you can. And doing so will increase the probability that it's going to show up, but you're pushing against at least 7 billion other people who also want things to show up, and the universe is trying to accommodate all of it at the same time. So there's an enormous amount of inertia that works against you. That's why you can't simply make it poof appear.
So I know that in the book you have some wonderful suggestions for affirmations and for making sigils and things like that. So I encourage people to look that up. And I want to thank you so much, Dean, for being with us today.
Happy to be here.
I've been speaking with Dr. Dean Radin. He's the chief scientist at the Institute of Noetic Sciences, and he's the author of Real Magic, Ancient Wisdom, Modern Science, and A Guide to the Secret Power of the Universe. And if you want to know more about his work, you can go to his website, deanradin.org, or you can get there through the New Dimensions website, newdimensions.org. I'm Justine Willis-Toms. You've been listening to New Dimensions. This is program number 3632.
New Dimensions Radio has been making a difference on our planet since 1973, thanks to the generosity of our listeners. You too can help make a difference with a tax-deductible donation or membership. Please visit our website, newdimensions.org, and just click the donate button. You can also subscribe to our free weekly podcasts and find over 1,000 hours of audio dialogues in our searchable archive. New Dimensions is produced by New Dimensions Radio in Santa Rosa, California, USA. Our executive producer is Justine Willis-Toms. Our post-production editor is Lou Judson. This program was recorded at Strawberry Hill Productions, a full-service podcast production studio in Novato, California. We sincerely thank all of you who have supported us by being members of Friends of New Dimensions, as well as members of our affiliate stations. My name is Dan Drayson. On behalf of everyone at New Dimensions, whose endeavors make this program possible, I'm wishing you well. New Dimensions Radio is an independent producer supported by listener contributions. To find out more about the program you've just heard, to subscribe to our free weekly newsletter and our New Dimensions and New Dimensions Cafe podcasts, and to access thousands of other programs in the New Dimensions archive, please visit our website, newdimensions.org. That's newdimensions.org, or call us at 707-468-5215. That's 707-468-5215. Please join us next time as we explore New Dimensions. New Dimensions is brought to you by Friends of New Dimensions membership support, and by Larson Publications, publisher of the book An Open Life, Joseph Campbell in Conversation with Michael Toms. New Dimensions and our quarter-hour New Dimensions Cafe programs are now available worldwide as podcasts. You can find them at the iTunes Store and on many podcast sites and mobile apps. You can also find our podcasts and much more on our website, newdimensions.org. Each week, New Dimensions explores the social, political, scientific, environmental, and spiritual frontiers with some of today's foremost social innovators, thinkers, scientists, and creative artists.
Hi, I'm Alanis Morissette. Next time on New Dimensions, I'll be talking about various versions of service in the world and how we can show up as our truest selves to serve.
Attention, women in science, technology, engineering, and math. Whether you're a seasoned professional or just starting on your journey, the Society for Canadian Women in Science and Technology is here to support you every step of the way. From mentorship programs to networking and skill-building events, we've got the tools and resources you need to succeed and thrive in STEM. Visit SCWIS.ca to learn more. That's SCWIST.ca. We can't wait to connect with you.